Hi, everyone, and welcome to Art and Labor, your favorite podcast about art and not having any work. I'm OK Fox.
And I'm Lucia Love, and I'm so happy to be here. I have so much work. I have all of the work. It's crazy. I just keep doing it, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everyone. I'm no good at slacktivism.
No, dude, you're great, and you're a really hard worker and skilled worker, and it totally makes sense. I'm applying for a job I might get.
Ooh.
Honestly.
What are you gonna get?
I don't know. It's like some stupid admin work for like a NYCHA development.
Weird.
Very weird, but a job nonetheless.
Yeah. No, it's good too because you'll get the inside track on housing.
I know. Well, that's the thing. It's like I don't want to work for the enemy. So like at first I was like, what's the developer? And they're like, oh, it's like a NYCHA garden project. And I'm like, well, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll do it. But then I feel like it's like if I stay on with like a company like that, who knows like what type of project they'll take on next. It'll probably be bad. But
well,
I can
hey, yeah, you can
leave.
Quit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And or you could get fired and then you could get back on unemployment.
Yes. 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 What I'm really hoping is that we get pandemic unemployment back, and then because everybody who's been on unemployment since pandemic unemployment has lapsed is entitled to any new thing from the Fed. So that would be a nice little chunk of change if that comes through.
Yeah, that's pretty convenient. They're like, hey, don't bother applying again. We know you didn't find a job.
It's more like if you've been, because I'm still on regular unemployment, but because like my shitty job was so, I earned so little, it's not enough.
What made
unemployment worth it was the extra 600 pandemic unemployment assistance. So like it feels like right now they're trying to like gut New Yorkers into, you know, taking really shitty, dangerous COVID jobs.
Yeah, they're trying to keep the system moving. They're like, yeah, just throw some more bodies in.
Yeah, so I'm trying not to land in too dangerous a job, but like the small amount of admin work might be doable. I don't know. We'll see.
Yes. Yes, I have faith.
So that's a life update. You had to move, of course, which is awful always.
Oh, yeah, moving again. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I just don't think about anything that has to do with housing. It's just a big old lump of scar tissue there in my life.
It sucks. It just sucks. I'm sorry. It's brutal. It's traumatic. Like, I don't know, watching that viral CNN clip about the evictions in Houston.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Just
luckily,
awful.
I'm not going through anything like that, but
it's you're in solid, like we're all in fucking solidarity with people who are going through insecurity. Like it's not right. Nobody should feel that way. Nobody should feel like they're a second from homelessness. Like nobody, like we live in a sick, disgusting, distorted society that makes people feel like, if they don't pay these grifter fucking landlords that, you know, that's all that, then they're just like immediately, about to get killed on the street or whatever.
Like, yeah, it really is. It really is quite an ingenious abstraction to allow people to keep fighting with this management class. It's just sort of like also like fighting with each other about how to appease the management class. Doesn't really seem like an intuitive thing to do. Like, oh yeah, let's all get mad at our friends.
That's the point.
give money to people we hate.
It's like a macro, or it's like a macro version or a micro version. It's a micro version of what's happening, you know, with the police, like and putting different, pitting different working class populations against each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, of course, we've discussed, you know, what do you do with those class traitors? We still don't know. They're armed to the teeth and they're running amok.
God, it did really help me to talk to some comrades who like had like a really big struggle session in their organization about what to do with killer cops. And listening to what they came to was, we don't currently live in abolition, of course. There's no reason for us to, treat like we don't have to live those principles under capitalism because it doesn't make sense. So as long as there are prisons, killer cops should be in prison.
Why not just switch it out? Like, we've got all these cops, right, and we've got all these weeds. We got all these weed smokers in jail.
Yeah,
why don't we let those out? And we just, you know, cops, they like to work. They're proud of doing their jobs and stuff. They could do them indoors for a while.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, go and arrest each other in there. Go wild.
Have their own little.
You know, just fill the jails up with all the cops, and then we'll just, it'll be like capture the flag. We just make one team like kind of be the criminals or something, and you're like, okay, now get each other in the cells.
Yeah.
And then we could like put some cameras in there and make it a TV show.
That.
And we could call the show Cops.
Yeah, Cops 2. No, it's Cops 2.
Yeah, Cops 2. Cops, Y2K.
Yeah, it's Cops 2020, and it's all the cops are in jail, policing each other in jail.
Yeah.
And all the regular people are free.
And then Joe Rogan comes in sometimes and is like, oh, hey, remember me? Like, I'm going to give you guys a challenge now.
Oh,
and they
God.
Have to do like, oh, they have God. To do like noodle fighting and stuff.
They do like,
and then at the end of the day. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's going to be awesome. It's like makes a little American Gladiator in there.
That is perfect. Yeah. Oh my God, geez, we're already off the rails.
I think, you know, this is good stuff. If y'all are at home and you're drawing, make a picture of Cops 2.
Yeah, what does Cops 2 look like to you? Like, what type of entertainment surrounding cops is beneficial to the working classes? And
yeah, how far is too far, basically? Do you think it's weird if we force them to fight each other?
I think they'd like it.
Yeah, we could. I mean, it's cool. We could just intro it like, find out who's the strongest, and they'll be down. They'll be like, yeah, I want to be the strongest cop.
That's the thing. Like, we could still like make the prisons more humane. Like, you know, we can give them PS2s like they have in Norway. And like, you know,
that's
we
right.
can take care of the prisoners better. But it's like, as long as prisons exist, like it should exclusively be for, you know, class traitors and the ruling class to be in. Like,
honestly, for too long has the ruling class gotten away with their crimes by wearing little ankle bracelets.
It's true. It's true. They're allowed to just.
It's not
enough. They're allowed to just fucking be in their 20 acre like compounds or whatever.
Yeah, they're like, oh no, I'm confined to my mansion.
For some reason, Bernie Madoff is the only one actually in prison.
Not oh sure yeah, and Ghislaine.
And Ghislaine, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Can't believe she's still alive.
I wonder if she's gonna get COVID.
Right?
Quote, COVID. But they,
you know, COVID is a rough one for them to hide, because she would have to like be visibly ill for 2 weeks. So I actually don't know if they're gonna pull that kind of shit.
Well, what if they actually give her COVID, legit?
Oh, okay.
And then it's like she has COVID, and they're like, "You're bad enough that you have to be on a quote unquote ventilator."
Oh my God. Yeah, maybe someone will just like pipe in a little vial of like COVID spew, and they'll just be tufting it into her nose, and they'll be like, "Come on, catch, get in there, go multiply." and they're like, "Oops, you got COVID now." Or maybe they'll, do you think that you can inject it into her?
Yeah, I do. I do think that. I don't see why not.
So they'll just like shoot her up with a little COVID, and then be like, just gonna wait for these little guys to do their handiwork.
Yeah, I mean, the only downside is like, yeah, some people don't show symptoms if they have it. So
that'd be pretty good. Yeah, that's like the Looney Tunes version where they're like, "All right, we got her now, boys," and they just like wrestle her down, shoot her up with COVID, and then they're watching her, and she's like, "Fit as a fiddle."
Oh my God.
Anyway, you guys got any kids around? I feel like kissing.
Oh my God. Okay, wait, we're going off the rails a bit. I think we should take a quick break. This is going to be new to some of our listeners, but we have a sponsor.
Oh, that's true. Enjoy. I'm Gary Fee, have a MasterCard.
I'm Gary Fee, have a Visa card. Hey, everyone. We have a sponsor today, Ovid TV.
That's right. Ovid TV. It's a new streaming service that is dedicated to providing content that is exactly the kind of stuff that we talk about on Art and Labor. They have a bunch of really great documentaries about workers, history of labor, and the history of cultural endeavors. So we've got one called Art and Oligarchs about the people who support the art world. We've got one called The Hermitage Dwellers, it's a look at this prestigious Russian museum from the viewpoint of the people who work there. And we've got one on economic justice highlighted. In particular, there's one that's called The Workers' Cup. It's about workers inside the labor camps in Qatar who are building everything for the World Cup there in 2022. So, you know, if you're interested in sports, you want to see.
God.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's
that
a lot going on.
That shit in Qatar is so fucked up. Like thousands of workers have just been brutally killed by that construction.
Yes. And so Ovid TV, that's OVID.TV, is bringing us some firsthand accounts of what's going on in labor all around the world. So, you know, check them out. They're a streaming service at $6.99 a month. And if you use the promo code LABOR, you get 50% off for the first 3 months.
I think that rules, because like that type of like documentary stuff is really hard to find. Like it's hard to pirate. It's hard to get on other streaming services. Like where else are you going to get stuff like this, especially if you're a researcher or something? I think it's completely worth it. It's probably something you can write off your taxes.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Check out.
I mean, and you know, it's pretty much like, yeah, everyone months ago was saying, oh, maybe this other service is going to be the leftist Netflix or the socialist Netflix. But it's entirely possible that actually this is the socialist Netflix. We're not sure yet. You know?
Yeah. Maybe there's several and we got to support these independent ones over. Like, cancel your fucking Disney Plus. What are you fucking doing? Pirate that.
Yes.
Cancel your Disney Plus.
Yes.
Idiots.
Homies.
What's wrong with you?
For $6.99 a month, you can support these fine folks who are giving you firsthand accounts of what it is like to be a worker internationally. So,
all right.
Pretty dope.
Thank you, Ovid. Thank you, Ovid.tv. Promo code labor. Thank you for supporting art and labor. Bye.
Let's have fun.
End of ad. And we're back. That was our little sponsor that we have now because, try to rely on just Patreon, but we're not the best at growing it, and it is what it is. I don't got a job. It's get some money.
Yeah, get some money. Bring some awareness to people who are also doing cool art stuff.
Yeah, it's not a bad spot. Yeah, I mean, I don't feel beholden to them editorially, so I don't care.
Yeah, I don't either. But you know. If y'all want to hear us talk about your stuff, like
email us.
Send us an email.
For sure. Yeah. So,
yeah, let's get serious now. We've been doing a lot of reading.
Yeah, we have, been doing a lot of reading. Like we were talking about like, eviction stuff and housing stuff like we tend to do. I've been kind of thinking about how Trump is probably going to win.
Oh God, yep.
So I don't know if we want to talk about the right first or if we want to talk about some more like inspirational politics that are helpful too.
Let's talk about the right first, and then we'll bring it up.
I think that's good.
Just yeah, here's the hell world, but there's lots of cool stuff to wash. You know, cleanse your palate.
Yeah, that's yeah. Because I'm curious about this piece you read in The Spectator.
Oh my God. Okay, so let me set this up for you. I saw this piece getting passed around by some people who are in the gallery world.
Who just don't know that The Spectator is like a extreme.
No.
They know.
They're Trump supporters.
Oh,
they're
fun.
Trump supporters.
All right, cool. Love that.
Just going to say, this is one of the projects that I've taken on because I have sort of limited time to scroll. And I just was like, wow, I'm going to really focus on this because it is amazing to me that there are Trump supporters in the art world. And like boggles my mind. But I guess, you know, whatever. People who are into money can also be into like cutting taxes and stuff.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, on a second look, it makes perfect sense. But so this is a piece and it's titled Trump Redefines the Race, and it is written by this guy, Daniel McCarthy, who, you know, he's just kind of like one of those conservative op-ed writers who's just been all across the board, but he's also was the internet communications coordinator of the Ron Paul 2008 presidential campaign.
Oh, great. One of these people.
Yeah. Fascinating blend just to end up in the art world.
Yeah, makes sense. A libertarian's gonna love a completely unregulated industry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. It's just, it's like, this is turning into like a, you know, they have like a supportive platform.
Okay.
And there's an easy in here. So I just wanted to pull out this little segment here and see what you think. Let's see here. This is Daniel McCarthy now. Snarky liberals say the GOP isn't the party of ideas anymore. They're wrong. under Trump, the GOP is so much the party of ideas that the Democrats are reduced to stealing them, even as they ignore the now defunct agenda of their own party's most recent president. The Republican convention was striking for the way speaker after speaker reiterated the key policies and themes, to the point where one speech often blurred into another, and it wasn't always clear what the primary takeaway from a speaker should be. On Wednesday, Keith Kellogg and Rick Grinnell both gave superb articulations of the Trump doctrine. Power and peace are its twin principles. But they and other speakers covered so much ground in their remarks that casual viewers may not have recalled any particular argument. There are advantages to an omnibus approach such as this, but downsides as well. The Trump team had so much that it wanted to tie together that at times the speeches were bursting at the seams. This was true of President Trump's own speech as well, which presented his vision comprehensively, but as a result of being so comprehensive, was also notably long. For pundits with short attention spans, this was agony, as anguished tweets revealed. Yet such a long speech was a sign not only of the scope of what Trump stands for, but also of the president's ability to stand and speak for much longer than his rival.
That, I mean, that is true. I guess the...
He can stand up and he can speak.
I mean, that is guys. More than the Democratic candidate has. I will give him that. But the argument he's making is basically... So we threw spaghetti on the wall to see what stuck. And now I'm just reading random tea leaves. Or like whatever. Like, it's like now I'm just reading the spaghetti on the wall. Like,
oh yeah. Well, this is amazing because he goes on to attribute like every possible thing to the Trump campaign.
Great.
It's insane. The president and his surrogates boasted of replacing NAFTA with USMCA, passing criminal justice reform, getting a significant tax cut through Congress, destroying ISIS, killing Soleimani, let's see.
A lot of shit. He's right that he said a lot of shit because he talked for like an hour and a half, like it was like a state of the union or something.
And he has heralded achievements in foreign policy and regulatory reform. Fucking A.
It's brutal. Like, it's really stupid that the Democrats have backed themselves into this. Like, I just hate how it's like, all right. I mean, that is true that we've yet to kind of see Biden articulate any policy. So, like, I will give them that. Like, it's insane. It's brutal. And like, the thing with like Trump giving anything, even if it's a lie, is going to work for him.
Well, the reason why it's kind of working in his favor as well is like the, you know, this article also does a good job of covering how, I mean, I say a good job, but you know, they have very tight propaganda where it's like, oh, all of the cities where these riots are happening and these terrible lootings,
that's
are
the talking
democratic.
Point.
And it's like, you know, they fucking got you there.
They really do. And like, you know, that's what, you know, bringing back to the, I meant to say this before about evictions, is like Trump did say that, you know, he's enacting this eviction moratorium, and that is more than what the Democrats are putting on the table for people facing evictions, which is like fucking nothing. They're just hoping that the president fucks up enough so that they could just waltz in the fall. Meanwhile, they're just seeding ground for months and months and months leading up to the election. It's really, really bad. Like, I you know, I don't say this shit because I agree. I say this shit because it's like, for them to not even lie about like doing anything for regular people is, it's, they're going to lose. They're going to lose. And like, it hasn't worked this whole full 4 years to point out constantly that Trump is a hypocrite and it's not, and his shit isn't actually going to work, or this isn't actually going to work, or, oh, isn't it stupid that Trump put his signature all over the checks? And it's like, no, that's fucking politics. Like, he's associating
it's, he knows how to make a brand.
It's so,
that's about it.
And that is what he knows how to do, and that's why he will win, because it is like, I get this argument. I get this argument that this shitty spectator guy is making, and it's just like, it's awful that like people, like, what really pisses me off about conservatives is that they're just like, when you critique the Democrats from the left, they're like, oh, well, why don't you vote Republican? And it's like, no, you guys are both horrible, horrendous. And like, there's,
yeah, but I think that is actually the that was what was coming up while I was reading this, was sort of feeling like, oh, maybe because our party, two-party kind of failure brigade is so divisive, it's just like, okay, you know, a lot of people here are indoctrinated against the left, so they're going to turn into libertarians. Yeah. And they're going to be like, well, you know, why allow politicians to plan anything if they are all so incredibly feckless? Trump is just actually showing us that this is all a major fucking charade. And now I'm QAnon instead of being a leftist.
Totally. Yeah, because I think the left made a mistake working with the Democrats. I mean, we couldn't have known that like something as serious as COVID was going to happen. But I can really appreciate that, you know, folks like the Nina Turners and Cornel Wests and like, more like radical end of like the Bernie campaign are now like all in on this like movement for a people's party.
Oh God. Yeah.
I think that's completely necessary, and they're going to get a lot of shit for it when Biden loses, but that's fine because it's extremely necessary to have that other option.
I mean, we had to try, you know, there had to be a moment of, you know, there had to be a Bernie campaign because in that historical moment, there was a lot of galvanizing energy that came out of it. And there had to be a visible loss that people could rally around and say, like, you know, we were expelled from the Democratic Party. It wasn't like we were being petty. You know, we tried. We put our best foot forward. We tried to work with the system. We were trounced and we were slandered. And now we're reconfiguring and consolidating our own power. And hopefully enough people can like be swayed away from the sort of politics of resentment to be able to, you know, actually form some solidarity.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of like, yeah, it's just going to be like a more intense version of like Jill Stein voters, blah, 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 blah. But it's just like,
oh, no.
It's just like, you know, I think people have gotten a lot sharper at countering that type of attack on the left. And that's just going to have to get honed. And by the next fucking cycle, this shit, like, it has to get built out. Like, there's no other way. We cannot, like, you know, I'm for insurgent campaigns in whatever form that takes. Like, I support, like, if that's like a strategy that makes sense in a certain locality or whatever, I'm for it. Like in New York, the two-party system is so deeply ingrained into the electoral system that it's difficult to undo it. But if it starts to get more undone in states where it's easier to have a successful third party, then hopefully in the future, like, some of these folks who had to run as Democrats can then switch to this other party in their re-election campaigns.
Yeah.
I think that's the hope. That's got to be, like, the way forward. I mean, not that, like, electoralism is, like, the only way forward. It's, like, several strategies are happening at once that have to happen at once, you know? Oh, can you hear me?
Ooh, hello?
Oh, okay. I'm still recording on my end, but hey, I was just saying, like, there's a lot of strategies happening at once. But
oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
It's, of course.
Yeah, yeah, electoralism is still a fraught business. I mean, it's even stranger now because, you know, we are instating this, you know, working people's platform, and it's kind of like anybody's guess what ranked choice voting is going to do with the possibilities moving forward, even if we are able to, like, you know, bundle up some resources and get some good campaigns going. It's still going to be like we're able to be flooded by establishment
totally
voter or I mean and if, campaigns,
you know, they have these,
you know,
giant PR machines, huge media conglomerates that are funded by these, like, establishment parties to keep these establishment parties afloat, and it's a huge hurdle that gets underestimated. You know, like the campaign in my neighborhood, like, it was really stupid. Like, it was like a three-way race. And there's, like, this incumbent, like, conservative Democrat. There's a young upstart fucking lady who turns out to be a Cuomo stooge. And then there's, like, a third candidate who is, like, you know, pretty much a fucking, like, like a communist, like, teacher. Like, yeah, just... great.
Oh, like a lovely human being.
The DSA didn't endorse that candidate because they were confused about this, like, upstart, quote unquote, progressive. They didn't have, like, the resources to do, like, the proper research on this woman. And, like, by the time the endorsement process was over, like, they just, like, didn't pick a side. But yeah, that's, like, one of the limits of electoralism. It's like, you know, you have... when you don't have enough resources and, like, you only have a limited window to endorse and you sit on the fucking fence.
Well, the DSA endorsement strategy has been a little bit whack from what I'm hearing in general because of the way that they're trying to, like, target certain areas in the city, and they have this strategy of, like, I don't know how to gossip about this. It sounds bad, folks. It sounds like perhaps they're not, I don't know. Sounds like they should be endorsing people that they're not.
Yes, it keeps happening.
Yeah, but it's all kind of based on this strategy of, like, building out power in neighborhoods that are not, like, predominantly white because they want to like focus more on working class voters. And it's all this sort of like weird metrics that are getting in the way of the reality of what they should be looking at. I think it's what I'm hearing, but again, you know, I'm just on the sidelines.
It just feels like there should be like a certain level of like, I don't know.
Yeah, because there's working class people in every neighborhood. And in the ones where there is like, you know, a disparity of wealth, it's even more important for them to have a voice, I would think. But I don't know. That's just me.
Oh, my goodness. It's just electoralism. It's a mess. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. And so is the place where I'm Jesus. At. Shoot.
Well.
Yeah. Everything is going crazy.
Guys, sorry. We have to cut this episode short because there's construction in Lucia's building.
It looks like we maybe have a little time.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah. We'll see. I've been reading this book, The Politics of Everybody, Feminism, Queer Theory, and Marxism at the Intersection by Holly Lewis. And I found a free PDF. I put it on my Twitter. I'll put it in the show notes as well. I can read if this little section that I took out here, it's a chapter called or about queer nationalism versus queer Marxism. And what I really like about this author is that she's able to like kind of systematically address like these issues from like many different theoretical perspectives, like, you know, feminist perspective, queer theory perspective, and the Marxist perspective, and the liberal perspective.
Now that's synthesis.
Really good. It's like really good synthesis because, like, to me, that always feels so daunting, you know, because it's like, I don't know all of these theories, you know, like that's a lot of different theoretical areas of study.
Yeah. But then, yeah, the nice thing about reading theory is that it all is, it's more like getting to know a cloud of understanding. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, oh, all these things keep getting referenced in different combinations, and then you get to know the relationships between them, and then you get to inform your life through those relationships instead of just like, oh, you don't know, like, you haven't memorized the dictionary?
Yeah, I'm like getting to the point where like I'm like, oh, I have like a pretty decent understanding of like these different tendencies, to the point where I'm like starting to get frustrated with certain anarchist tendencies. You know, like
well, I think anarchy is usually the most frustrating, but ultimately necessary, because they give us ideas like abolishing inheritance.
Right. I mean, I love shit like that. I love shit like, you know, abolishing private property. Yes, that is that, but that, you know, goes along with like a program of dismantling capitalism. Like, I don't know. I've been thinking about like how, like liberal media is able to take anarchist texts and kind of present them as like new ideas in a way that like just completely erases like historical context, like, you know, or Marxism, which is, you know, grounded in like a historical materialism. And I've been like, you know, I feel like getting a better handle on that, like formulating that criticism in this book in particular helped me, you know, square a lot of circles. Like I'm constantly this type of person who I'm very enamored with the idea of queer separatism. I'm very like, yeah, I'm ready to fucking drop out. I'm done being mistreated, and I just want to be surrounded by like-minded people.
You could, yeah, you just do like a Black Mountain College, but for queerdos.
Exactly. And it's like, and I totally get that, but that's why I really appreciate the critique of that. And this chapter in particular, I can read some parts I highlighted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, give us the choice bits.
But working class queer people didn't just abandon the streets because of what some academics were saying. Neoliberal pressures, the privatization of space, the privatization of the media, and targeted ideological offenses against working class solidarity are more likely factors in the relative decline of organized queer street politics. So she's talking about like a critique of ACT UP and how ACT UP went from being a radical project to a liberal project.
Which is like very telling, like, or kind of informative in the face of what's happening to like Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think like this shit is important, and she's doing it in a way that's not admonishing, right? It's not fucking blaming.
Well, no, it's like this trend, you know?
Right. And she's saying that it's like, if people are interested, read the book, because like she critiques it in a through love. It's not through admonishing their actions. It's through a deep understanding of the conditions that forced them to do that. Like the other thing that gave me a lot of like inspiration this week was happening upon the grave site of the Workman's Circle, and then reading a lot about the Workman's Circle Mutual Aid Project, and just seeing so many parallels to the mutual aid projects that have popped up during the pandemic here in New York City, and how similar their principles are to like the principles of like the mutual aid group that I'm a part of, or like that a lot of folks are working on. Like, let me read that. So here's from the Workman's Circle principles. The constant want and frequent illness, which particularly afflict the workers, have led us to band together so that by united effort, we may help one another. The Workman's Circle, however, is aware that the aid it is able to offer the working people today is like a drop in the bucket. It will do in time of need, but that there shall be no need, that is the ideal. The spiritual object is the object of helping to develop in working people a sense of solidarity, a clear, enlightened outlook, the striving by means of their unity to acquire that influence in ultimately bringing on the day of their complete emancipation from exploitation and oppression. So grounding that mutual aid project in this goal of emancipation, and recognizing that it's not enough to do these type of projects, and that there is a larger political project beyond them, I think is so key in this type of political work.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, it's like, kind of reminding me of all of the ruptures in our movements where it's like, oh, you know, NBA is going on a wildcat strike. They definitely care about issues, but in a way that has, it's sort of like localized aid or like localized interest, and it hasn't quite been attached to a national effort.
Yeah.
Or an international effort,
yep.
But it can be, as we see all of these actions continue in different sectors, and all of a sudden, you know, because we know we have a natural care for each other, we can politicize this and turn it into a greater sort of force.
Yeah, and then, I think we have to,
I don't know.
It's for sure, and I think like studying the Workman's Circle was really helpful for me to synthesize that, because like they had all these different, like the Workman's Circle, similar to ACT UP, starts out as this like radical mutual aid project of, you know, providing for sick people and working people, and slowly became more liberalized. By the workman circle is still around today, but it's like, you know, an NGO. It's like it's a liberal project. And there was all these different sects within the workman circle that were, you know, the like, little caucuses agitating for different directions. And I think if they were able to stick to the more communist international, like the Bundists, were advocating for, it would look a lot different. But of course, like, it would have made them, people are scared, you know, people are scared of being persecuted for being a communist. Like, and so that's why they had to change.
Well, there's that. I mean, yeah, there's definitely like the history of persecution, the history of failure, and then there's sort of the understanding that because we work within a capitalist structure, the way that most organizations are capable of surviving is by retooling themselves as they grow, which inevitably kind of replaces those mutual aid components with, like, you know, capitalist ideology, like what an NGO runs off of, what a nonprofit runs off of. Like, but it's because literally organizations will dissolve in the system. It's like we're in a saltwater tank and we're dropping freshwater fish into it. They either learn how to, you know, breathe in saltwater or they die. And we have to change the kind of like saline solution that we're in.
Totally. Yeah. It becomes interesting to me to study the different positions that, you know, became minorities within the group. And if they had been the majority, what would have happened? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I've been kind of entertaining some similar alternative histories with the original Internationale and the way that a lot of people who organized with the first communist party, they had an idea actually of where religion and spirituality could be integrated into the movement and what that would mean for people. And like, you know, it kind of would play off of ideas that Spinoza kind of brings out, or it sort of like would make a more Buddhist communism. Because of the, you know, the spirituality of being connected and being one. And, you know, so there was this initial schism that happened, which was like, oh, we have to be strict historical materialists. Like, oh, if I can't see it and I can't touch it, then it has no place in my rhetoric. It's like kind of this weird idea that splits the reality of people, which is that we do have a spiritual life that can be utilized, but like has been totally sidelined by economic interests.
Yeah, I want to bring it back to the politics of everybody. There's a section that's very relevant to that critique of classical Marxism. Classical Marxism, held back by its usual knee-jerk suspicion of cultural politics, failed to keep up with much of the argument. Long into the 21st century, the term queer was still emblematic of postmodern contamination. Ironically, for all of the Marxist complaints about the corrosive elements of identity politics, it was precisely an identity politics that early critics of Marxist queer theory were demanding. The identity of not having an identity was not readily seen as a possible opening towards a genuine internationalism, nor was it viewed as a struggle between all those unnamed by the current system and those who wish to categorize them for their own benefit. Much of the
I feel so seen.
You're seen, dude. Much of the classical Marxist tradition constructed a false choice between the three political modalities: reactionary protection of the family from erosion by capitalism, liberal pluralism, and a vision of liberation connected to the good old days of yesteryear's material conditions. Thankfully, a new generation of queer and trans Marxists are beginning to think through gender within the current challenges posed by the neoliberal age.
That's so cool. I love that so much. I love that they addressed the identity of having no identity.
Yes, the white identity politics. And I've been getting into that too. I've been getting back into W.E.D. Du Bois.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Like the concept of like wages of whiteness and like when that runs out, what happens, you know, to all of these like insane, you know, militia type people, for example, who were sold a psychological wage that they are no longer getting.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I mean, it just really highlights how arbitrary all of these delineations are, where we can keep sort of hashing out what our relationship is to an ever-changing matrix of inputs and then kind of stay connected to like a hierarchical structure that keeps all of these things stable when they really aren't. Or we could start looking at how mutable everything is and how it is a travesty to be oppressed based on any of these factors.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I think that I don't think that that's unmoored from historical materialism. I think that is, in line with, like, you know, the adjustments that, you know, the different iterations of the Internationale have been reckoning with, you know, for a long time. I don't know. I think there is, I don't know. I'm still working on, you know, I'm trying to be better read. I'm getting there. But I do reject, you know, the types of, you know, commercialized radical politics that are easily laundered through liberalism. I will say that. I think that, like, when we are writing and thinking, we should be grounded in an explicitly socialist project. And I think that that makes, our case stronger. I don't appreciate the, like, shying away from what a political program of, like, socialism or communism is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds really cool. I just don't ever know what people are talking about when they say explicitly socialist project. I'm just like, what? Sorry, that I don't know. I have been like kind of stripping myself of like those kinds of identities. I'm not like, oh, I'm definitely a communist. Like, I don't really know, because a lot of the people that I've met who are like, oh, yes, I'm definitely a communist, they just kind of rail about like this specter of like these goddamn individuals everywhere being all for themselves and saying words that they understand inside of their communities. It's offensive to me. And I'm like, you know, I definitely don't want to do that. So instead, I think I'm just going to make my life into like supporting things that I know I believe in. Like, wow, I really don't want to push people into anything like, you know, being a stable gender or something. Like, you have to perform gender. I'm going to make you do that when you're around me. Like, nope, never going to do that. If that means I'm socialist, then sweet.
Right.
But I'm not going to go around with a bunch of pins anymore. I don't know about it. Maybe later I will.
I don't know.
Once I retool it, you know.
I'm not talking about it as like a personal identity. I'm talking about it as a coherent politic. I don't know if you're going to say you know, go through the academic institutions and write a book and do, you know, media campaigns about you know, stuff like concepts like looting or like these, you know, what was the other one that was bothering me? There's just like, I keep coming across.
Well, at the end of the day, there is the Jacobin,
right?
Like kind of writer who's like, I'm Mr. Leftist. Listen to me.
Yeah.
Screw them.
It's
honestly, looting is good. Cops are bad. Gender is fluid. People deserve to live well.
Looting is good because it's expropriation. It's literally like,
yeah,
it fits into.
But I think, you know, absolutely. Expropriate wealth, obviously. But I'm just, you know, it's like, if that means that I'm a socialist, then good. I do believe those things. But I'm not going to go and lead with terminology anymore. I'm just going to be like, oh yeah, this resonates with me.
I think that's fair.
And I will
show up for it. I think that's fair. And I think it can, like, terms are alienating and weird to people. So I get the strategy there too. I understand that position totally. I mean,
it's kind of been more like, you know, if you want to be a labor organizer, that means you also have to be like the hardest worker. I've just been, I kind of have like internalized that. I'm like, oh yeah, I work hard and I show up. And as a result, I will share the things that I made and I will just show you, this is what, here, do you need something? Here you go.
Yeah. I'm like the opposite. I'm like, I want to organize around labor so that people don't have to work as hard.
Oh yeah. I'm just, like, I guess if there was a term for me, then I'm like kind of a workerist.
Mm-mm.
It's like, yeah, it's weird. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious about the book you're currently reading, that talked about that sort of like, that type of like person,
yeah,
the type of person
that
who,
schism.
Yeah. Cause I feel like I'm definitely the camp of like, people should work less and,
right.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's why I'm kind of like, you know, there's nothing prescriptive that I can say about how people should be living their lives, except I know absolutely that you cannot add to the suffering of others. Like, absolutely, bottom line, do not. But yeah, as far as outside of that, it's just so hard for me to make any hard and fast rules because it's like, oh, everyone should be liberated from work. And I'm like, dude, I work, my mental health is the best when I'm constantly working. I don't know.
No, yeah, I think it's an each according to their need situation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, and so then if it's like, well, yeah, I mean, if we're sticking to that and then we're calling ourselves communists, then I think it's great, which is why I'm like, we still need anarchy because it allows, anarchy is like the little space between molecules that allow them not to, like, you know, have a little friction explosion.
What I appreciate, because there's I appreciate about anarchy is that it grounds, it can ground our thinking in a utopian post-socialist vision, like, of what, like, how we should function, you know, beyond capitalism, and like people can live that. Can try to live that in capitalism, and that's good practice for a future without it. Or, you know, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
I'm cool with the communes. Like, I'm not going to admonish them. I think it's cool, and I relate, and I want to. I would love to join one, but I'm also like understand the criticism of them at the same time. Just both things are true. Like, you know.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing. I'm like, wow, everything is way too wavy for me to actually align myself with anything. It's more, I like way too like, oh, I'm going to show up when I feel like I'm going to have a beneficial sort of, you know, additional presence. Otherwise, it's like, well, I don't know if people are trying to make a separatist move, that's cool. Definitely not trying to loop everybody together. Sometimes I think, like, you know, everyone breaking up into little cells is better.
Little nodes.
Yeah.
There just has to be good communication between those nodes. And we do live in a time, fortunately, when there is better international communication than ever. So it's an interesting tactic. Yeah, I think I'm a kind of a diversity of tactics person, like we talked about earlier, where it's just like, you know, do all the strategies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And don't get too caught up with the political alignment charts, because.
But also take criticism.
The language will screw you.
I think take criticism. Yeah. If you are putting yourself out there with a book, the point of putting yourself out there with a book is to take criticism from fellow leftists. If all the anarchists and communists in the United States are going to be on the same team right now, then we all have to fucking talk. We can't just like be really, really divisive and mean and like, and then hurt also. I think like hiding yourself in a cocoon of hurt when you're like trying to put out a radical or revolutionary proposal is bad. I think we all have to talk.
I agree. Right now this vacuum is talking poorly in the background.
Thank you, vacuum, for your input. With that, we should close out.
Yeah. The vacuum is the sound of the workers taking in all of that excess capital.
Oh my God. And just trying to figure it out and just sucking in all the information.
Yeah, we'll filter it out later.
Well, let's have fun, everyone.
Lots of fun. Lots of fun. Lots of fun. Lots of fun.